Hello and welcome to this episode of Null Signal Station, a podcast from Null Signal Games about a bit of the behind the scenes of Null Signal Games. This is episode 11 and we're really excited today to talk about rules in general. We've got Jamie, the rules manager, with us, and we'll introduce them in just a moment. Because we've got a lot to talk about. We've got the Ashes remastered to talk about. We've got the publication of Rebellion Without Rehearsal. Just before we get into it, I'd like to say hello. I'm Ginevra. They or she pronouns is fine. I'm a Netrunner player from Australia and part of Null Signal Games. And with me is Sanjay.
Hello, it's Sanjay Kolkacek. I am from Newark, Delaware. Pronouns are he, him. It's lovely to be here today. How are you doing, Ginevra?
I'm well, thank you. It's early morning, so I'm waking up. And how was the Rebellion Without Rehearsal, like, reveal and preview season and spoiler season for you?
Oh, I really loved it. I think despite working for a little bit with Null Signal Games, I don't actively contribute to making the cards. And so I try to keep from looking at them. And it was absolutely lovely, seeing spoiler season. I did get to participate a little bit in spoiler season. My friend Jonas Wilson, on the basis of doing very well in America's Continental Tournament, got to make a card and made the card Amelia Earhart, which is a reference to his departed crow. And I got to make a wingspan version of that to help him spoil his card. So that was very fun. But more broadly, I've been enjoying seeing the cards and I've been enjoying playing with them. I've been still just playing a lot of Atea, and I've taken up Nuvem SA. It's been great.
Cool. Yes, I played Nuvem also as my first go round, but I feel I haven't had the chance to really get into the cards properly yet. I also want to give a shout out to Not Again, because it was really fun watching the card spoiler on GLC. I really enjoyed that. Anyhow, we should get into the show.
Let's go. Hello, and welcome to the interview section and the Rules Corner section. We are joined by Jamie Perconti, the Rules Manager of Null Signal Games, aka Infinite Nutshell. Pronouns are they, them. Jamie, it's so good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Jamie, just to start us off, would you mind telling us about how you got interested in Netrunner and how you became the Rules Manager of Null Signal Games?
Yeah, it's been a long time now. I've been playing since about since Jackson Howard came out. so I wasn't in right when the FFG core set dropped in 2012, but not that long after. And not that long after I started playing, I wound up judging the weekly tournament at the local game store, and then I wound up playtesting for FFG, and I sort of became one of the rules experts, ended up involved in the Anchor unofficial FAQs for the latter part of the FFG era. And then I've been on the rules team at NSG since the beginning. So I've been doing this for a while, and it's kind of my thing.
I guess I'm going to ask questions from a newer person's perspective, and I was going to ask, like, if someone is wanting to get an overview of all the rules, where are the rules actually found? Like, is there a hierarchy to what should they look at first, and sort of more authoritative, less authoritative, and stuff like that?
Yeah. So nullsignal.games/rules. has links to all of the rules resources that we currently have from NSG. There are learn to play guides for the corp and the runner, as well as a run timing guide. And then there's a link that says Netrunner Comprehensive Rules, which goes to its own hub page, where you can find all of the more advanced rules resources. So the comprehensive rules is the big document that lays out in technical detail all of the rules of Netrunner. And so you can find the current version of that as a PDF. You can find a PDF with changes from the previous version highlighted. You can find the other document that we have, which is the card text updates document. Although you don't usually need to go to that because we try to keep NetrunnerDB updated with the official text of cards whenever we do text updates. And then you can also find previous versions of those documents on the Comp Rules Hub.
Now, I know I'm somebody who enjoys reading comprehensive rules for games that I play or even have heard of, but I think not everybody needs to do that, right? At what point in your Netrunner journey would you picture somebody looking at the comprehensive rules?
When you have a question that doesn't get resolved easily, just through your community or giving the card another reading. Reading the card again is always a helpful technique for solving a rules question. But when you find yourself stuck, the comprehensive rules is there as a reference. And in fact, it's recently gotten much easier to use as a reference because not only do we have the PDF, we now have an online browser-based version of the comprehensive rules document at rules.nullsignal.games. And in that version, each individual rule is, there's a hyperlink, so you can link to a specific rule, and apps like Discord and so forth will even give you a little preview if you paste the link in there. So it is really helpful if you're having a rules conversation online and want to share the citation for whatever you're talking about.
Can I ask a little bit about, I am so thrilled for rules.nullsignal.games to exist because not that I mind hugely browsing through a big PDF, but especially on my phone during a tournament, if I'm, organizing the tournament, it's really nice to have that. How did that come about? I assume the rules team, or was it just the rules team endeavor? Was it a collaboration between the rules team and another team? How do we have this now?
So it's something that we've wanted to do for quite a while. I think it's good to have multiple formats. We try to we care about accessibility in NSG, and PDFs are not, they're not universal. They're not convenient in every situation. So it's good. It's good to have more things. And when we finally got the time to actually implement the new, so we had to overhaul our entire workflow for doing the CR.
Gosh.
We used to do it in a giant Google Doc. And then export that to a PDF, and that's how we made the PDF. But turns out Google Docs doesn't scale that well when you have 100-plus page document with lots of comment threads discussing like changes and rewrites and things that we're doing. It got really laggy, and it's hard to like search through the comments and find the discussion that you're looking for. And so we needed an overhaul anyway. And while we were doing that, it was a great opportunity to add more formats. So Ruben Peters is one of our rules associates and took the lead on that whole transition. We now have a Git repository where we like actually have files with text, and it's you know, it's like semantic tagging to indicate like what is introducing a term and what is a reference to a card name and what is a step or a subsection or whatever. And we can use actual version control tools to manage changes. And then having it in a plain text format means that you can parse it and export it to different formats, which you can't do the same way with something that's already in a highly formatted thing like a Google Doc.
That sounds cool. I'm keen to explore it and play around with it a bit.
Big shout out to Ruben. It's a great piece of work, and it's very exciting.
I guess we've been planning a rules episode for a while. So we actually wanted to talk about the Ashes remaster and I guess System Gateway remaster, if that's relevant. And were there any rules things that came up during that process?
Lots of things. The bulk of the work in putting together the remasters was rules work. It was updating all the cards to our most recent text style. So in the rules team, we're always looking for ways to improve the clarity and readability and just make it easier to understand and play with the cards. And with System Gateway and System Update, there were just a handful of things that needed to change. We had a big style overhaul when we did System Gateway. We introduced Breach as the new term for what used to be called accessing cards, which is different from the plural of accessing a card. And then, you know, we added the interface keyword for icebreakers, and we changed the terminology for servers so that every server has a root. And that's always the place where cards are installed. And so there have been a handful of things where we've made changes and we updated accordingly. But it's been smaller since then. Now, Ashes, we did before System Gateway. And that needed a big overhaul to get all the cards up to the way we write them today. So there are lots of stories about Ashes cards and things that changed that we're going to be talking about.
So I'm wondering about Ashes, because you said that was a lot more work. Can you tell us any stories about specific cards and the changes that needed to be made and why they were needing to be made?
Yeah. So a couple of examples of just the big changes that happened with System Gateway in terminology. So Hoshiko Shiro, the Anarch identity from Uprising, used to have a wording that was very particular in order to avoid the access a card versus accessing cards distinction that used to exist. And now we can just refer to breaching when we mean breaching. And if we want to talk about accessing cards, then that's just accessing. There's no gotcha in there. So the new wording for Hoshiko is just when your turn ends, if you accessed a card this turn, gain 2 credits and flip this identity. And on the other side, when your turn begins, draw 1 card and lose 1 credit. When your turn ends, if you did not access any cards this turn, flip this identity. The old wording I don't have in front of me, but the old wording was very particular about accessing at least one card to be clear, because in the past there have been, like, there's Eater, for example, was an older card that it was an AI icebreaker, could break anything, but if you used its break ability, it said you cannot access more than zero cards. So, like, you can still breach the server, but that wasn't a term yet at the time. But you can't access... You can access cards, but you can't access cards. And now that's much easier to talk about.
Right. There's, I guess, also the card Almakua, which cares about, did you breach? Did you... And on the original card, it says, did you access cards? Did you get to the access cards part of the run?
Right. And that's... probably the most important clarification that we were able to make. Almakua was kind of a driving factor behind introducing the breach terminology, because that was such a gotcha. It was very confusing that accessing a card and accessing cards don't mean the same thing, and different cards work for them in different ways, but they sound like the same words. So if you are wondering about subtleties of Almakua, look at the official text on NetRunnerDB, and that will hopefully make things easier to understand than what's printed on the card. So some more examples, just like a style change, the terminology, the companions all changed. So they used to say, when you install this or your turn begins, put a credit on it. And now they follow the way that we wrote cards like Botulus in System Gateway, where it's when you install this resource and whenever your turn begins. So just, you know, lots of small changes. We're very particular, and we think very hard about almost every word on the cards.
Yeah.
La Costa Grid is another card that is arguably more clear with the System Gateway rules changes. So La Costa Grid is an upgrade in Jinteki. It's 3 to res, 4 to trash. It's a region, it's CD, and it says remote server only. When your turn begins, place one advancement counter on a card in the root of this server. Limit one region per server. So we added the root part because it used to be that remote servers didn't have roots, and the term for a card that was installed was just in the server. And that's really subtle, right? In the server, it's easy to get confused, especially if you're a newer player, about in versus in the root of versus protecting. And there were always roots, like central servers had roots, but in the server for a central server meant in the zone, in your hands for HQ, in your deck for R&D. And that meant there were some weird things with upgrades that, like, worked differently on a central server from a remote server in ways that you wouldn't expect. Of course, La Costa Grid doesn't have that piece of the problem because it has remote server only, but just being able to say, okay, terminology is going to be the same now. Anything that's installed goes in the root. And in the server, which is still kind of a little awkward terminology, like in is a very small word.
Yeah.
So we try to be conscious of that and avoid writing cards that make you think something more general is going on when we specifically mean, no, in HQ. But we don't have that problem anymore for remote servers, and things are, I think, cleaner.
I guess, speaking of sort of new terminology and also just, you know, more specifically using terminologies to avoid confusion, one, I guess, absolute triumph of the rules team generally has been the set-aside zone. And I think in your notes preparing for the podcast, you had mentioned that you had done some stuff with the set aside zone as well.
We had started playing around with the set aside zone as a piece of rules technology for the original release of Ashes. So Gachapon always said set aside cards. So the only thing we had to change is nowadays we always explicitly say whether a card is setting aside face up or face down. So we just added face up to Gachapon. And then the big one is Kushuk. So Kushuk is a shaper card from Downfall. It's spelled K-H-U-S-Y-U-K. But I understand that the pronunciation is Kushuk. And it has a pretty complicated effect. So you run RMD, and then you check your installed cards. You figure out how many installed cards you have that all have the same cost. And you access that many cards. And on top of having to write all of that in a way that made sense, there's also weird interactions. Like, what happens if you steal a bacterial programming while you are doing the Kushuk thing? It's really unintuitive. So we have cleaned that up. We have eroded Kushuk. It is a functional change, but we feel it's much easier to understand those corner cases, which is the only place where it would be a functional change, are the corner cases. So now it uses set aside. So the updated text of Kushuk is run R&D. If successful, instead of breaching R&D, choose an install cost greater than 0 credits. The corp sets aside the top X cards of R&D face up, where X is equal to the number of your installed cards with that printed install cost up to 6. Access one of the set aside cards. The corp shuffles the set aside cards into R&D. So it's still a mouthful. Yeah. But we're also have sort of our stance on when it's appropriate to use X's has evolved. And we've also clarified how other sort of quantifiers work. Like, there are more specific rules about what for each means than there were back in the Ashes era.
Can you tell me more about how your thoughts about using X's has evolved? I'd love to hear more about that.
So I like X. I think it has just using a variable, having like a name for a quantity is a good way to abstract an idea that would otherwise be pretty complex, either in just having to think about it or just the text that it takes to describe it interrupting the flow of the sentence. So generally we're using X more than we used to. There is some pushback on that. There are some people in Null Signal that don't like X, and I can understand that because algebra can be intimidating. I think it's not something that I've seen a lot of players have trouble with in practice, but like the conventional wisdom is that using X's is high complexity. And so we're always trying to find the right balance between different forms of complexity, right? Like, if the card is easier to understand overall, assuming you're comfortable with the concept of a variable, that could be a better solution for a lot of people. But if it's like, if it's only a little more clear and there's another way that we could write it that works for maybe if somebody has a little more trouble with that concept. So we think about all kinds of issues like this. Like, we think about, okay, we're writing a card. Well, this phrase has a way that you could read it that is wrong, but what if someone reads it like that anyway? How do we keep them from, like, going even further astray? And sometimes that turns into, we find a different phrase altogether, and sometimes it turns into, well, there's not really a totally unambiguous way to write this sentence so that there's only a single way that you can parse it. But we try to make the most reasonable thing and guide the player to the getting the functionality as best we can. And it's all trade-offs, right? Like, the other big pressure on writing cards is the space in the text box. So yeah, that is a pressure that, you know, we have to be keenly aware of, and that we have to, like, bring back to the dev team. Sometimes they'll give us a card that, you know, maybe has been playtesting very well, and it's like, this just will not fit. We have to simplify this. It's not going to fit on a card.
Also with wanting to have a little bit of flavor text as well.
Yeah. We negotiate with the narrative team on flavor text. There have been cases where we've used wording that's a little more terse than our usual standard in order to help make room for flavor text. But you know, it's a, designing a card game is a huge balancing act of so many different factors.
Appreciate that. Another question, you know, with regard to the Ashes remaster, Ruben put out an article talking about some comprehensive rules changes that went along with it. And I would love to ask you about that article. I know there was some discussion about no change in game state. And I think for our listeners who might not be as excited about rules, would you mind talking about what no change in game state is in general, and maybe like what the current Netrunner rules do about it, maybe why, and what thoughts on it are?
Yeah, so the no change in game state rule has been around since midway, maybe early in the FFG era, and it started to get introduced more prominently and clarified, and sort of how we ended up where we are with it started with Geist. So Armand Geist Walker was a old criminal ID from the Sansan cycle that let you draw a card whenever you used a trash can ability. The problem is that there are some trash can abilities that you really shouldn't be able to use at any arbitrary time. And now that matters. So Geist's console, it's not really Geist's console because it's a burner, but it's called Forger. And its ability is plus one link instead of plus memory, which is a interesting and weird thing. But the main ability is trash can to avoid or remove a tag. Right? So that and other cards like it that have an ability that doesn't make sense on its own, that you only want for like the side effect of triggering Geist and drawing a card, or later when Tech Trader came out and had the same trigger condition and give you money. So that FFG wanted to avert that kind of problems. So they introduced this blanket rule that says you have to look at the potential of an ability to change the game state without regard to side effects. Like, you look at the ability itself and what it could do, and anything that triggers off of it or otherwise happens like secondarily as a consequence, doesn't count. And you have to pass that check and say that something is going to happen from the ability directly in order to activate that ability. So that's what no changing game state means and where it came from. A lot of games use different systems for this kind of like structural thing of just sort of making things make sense as far as when you can use abilities. So like Magic the Gathering uses a very robust targeting system. Like you can't cast a spell without declaring legal targets for it. And there are a bunch of rules in the Magic comprehensive rules about how targets work and what that means and what happens if a target becomes illegal in the middle of resolving a spell or while it's on the stack. But it takes a lot of work to put all of those systems together. And so the reason we still have the no change in game state rule is, the rules team is a few of us, we're volunteers. We have a lot of projects. We write the CR, we write the final card text, rules text for every card, et cetera. And we just haven't been able to, do all of the research and understand all of the implications and get the right replacement for it. The reason that we want to replace it is that it's unintuitive, the ability itself doing something versus side effects and secondary consequences thing. So the two main cards nowadays that the no change in game state rule is affecting are sort of on opposite ends. So on the one side, you've got Reconstruction Contract, which has a trash can ability that, has no timing restrictions written in there. And it says that you can move the advancement counters from it to another card. You're not allowed to trigger that ability if there are no advancement counters. But you might want to, especially if you're playing op. And trashing one of your own cards lets you do something else. So that's a balance issue. Right? Like, if you could just pop a recontract at will, that would be a big deal for op. So that's something that, like, either we'll need to errata to preserve that, or maybe the card will need to be banned if it turns out to be the best plan is a system in which that restriction goes away. But that's, like, the one end of the spectrum, like, no changing game state is serving its intended purpose, doing an important role. On the other end, you have the confusing case where it really doesn't need to be there, and the card would be so much nicer if it didn't have that gotcha, where, technically you can't use the card this way because it doesn't change the game state in the specific way that the rule is looking for. And that card is Simulchip. So Simulchip has you trash a program as an additional cost if you haven't already trashed a program this turn. And then the effect of the ability is to install a program from your heap with a discount and stuff. But no change in game state only looks at that effect. It doesn't look at the costs. So even though you always have, if you have a program on the board, you always have a logical, intuitive play of, I'm going to trash the thing to reinstall that same thing. But if there are no other programs in your heap, the no change in game set rule can't find a target for that install from heap ability because you haven't paid the cost yet when it's checking to see if you can use the ability in the first place. So it's this whole twisted knot. I believe that people have made like flowcharts of when you're allowed to use Simulchip. And it's, you know, it's not ideal. And the reason that we've left the ruling in place is we want to do it right when we fix it. Right? We do want to fix no change in game state and replace it with something that gets rid of the gotcha for Simulchip and still handles so something like a targeting system or but we haven't gotten there yet. However, we did take a first step, not a first step, second or third step, alongside the Ashes release, and we got rid of another one of the weird cases that kind of used to be its own special exception. So, one of the basic actions is click, play an event from your grip, or if you're the corp, play an operation from HQ. When does that have the potential to change the game state? When can you use that action? Well, if you have a card in your hand that you can play, that you can afford. But it used to be the case, and this is what we changed as we got rid of this special exception. It used to be the case that events and operations went a level deeper. You would actually look at the card you wanted to play, and does that have the potential to change the game state? And that means that you can't, like, play a diesel if your stack is empty, or do... It's mostly corner cases, and like there's not a reconstruction contracts situation where like the rule is doing important like groundwork holding up the structure of the game. When we made this change, there were only three cards that needed to be updated in order to make them not break from that change. And those were the reprisals from Katara Cycle and the Jinteki ones from Raining Reverie. They all have an effect that has you pick a target and then the runner has to do one of two things. So like, trash the card that you picked or take a bunch of damage. If there's nothing to pick, then the runner wouldn't be able to resolve the trash that one, so they would be forced to take a bunch of damage, which is pretty absurd. But all three of those cards had the same fix of let's just put a play restriction on them that says play only if there is, and then the description of the type of card that you're supposed to pick. And then it just works normally. And that was the only thing we had to change. We did get to change two other cards. So Scavenge is an old card from all the way back in, I think, Creation and Control.
That's my recollection, yeah.
That let you do a Simulchippy kind of thing of trash a card and then trash a program and then get a program out of your heap, discounting the result. And that was actually one of the first cards in the FFG era to get eroded, because it was originally written as an additional cost to play the event, trash a program, and then the effect on the event was just install a program from your heap. So it had that same Simulchip gotcha. And they eroded it to make the trash not a cost and put it into the effect, which is a little weirder. It makes the card it's not super weird, but it makes the card sort of flow a little less naturally, in my opinion. But it removed that gotcha in like a brute force kind of way. Of just saying, this is now part of what the no change in game state rule is allowed to consider, because it's no longer a cost, it's part of the effect. And in Ashes, we did a similar card called Rejig, which lets you pick up a card to your grip and then install a different card or the same card at a discount. And that was written the way that Eroded Scavenge was written. But now that we've removed the second level no change in game state check for events, we can go back to the original wording of Scavenge. And so the new version of Rejig has a new wording in that style, where you have an additional cost to play the event to pick something up, and then the effect is install a thing at a discount. So that was a whole lot of words about no change in game state and the history and where we are, and how it affected Ashes. And from here, it's just we gotta do the work and figure out what we're gonna do to finish the job and fix Simulchip.
Well, I appreciate it, because I hope, I don't know how plugged into community response to rules articles you are, but people got sincerely excited about this, you know, you might say like my rules minutia thing, like, finally, no, fine. I have a friend who actually doesn't play anymore, and every time there's a rules thing, like, did they touch no change in game state yet? It bothers him even today. You know, fix it, maybe he'll come back. I'd love that. So I appreciate you having that deep dive into it. So am I understanding right that now when you're playing an event, you get to say, yeah, I'm changing the game state. There's an event. It's leaving my hand. It's going to go do something. I am changing the game state by playing an event.
That is correct. You no longer have to do any further checking. And again, the only three cards that like broke and became significantly more powerful without that restriction were the three reprisals. And they now have in their official text just the restriction that they need written out explicitly.
Yeah, so you can't wake up call somebody to just hit them in the head with a baseball bat. Yeah, wake up. Boom.
You do have to have a hardware or whatever it is to target.
All right, thank you.
I'd like to move on to asking, I guess that was like going back and looking at and revising rules from Ashes. I'd now like to look at, what's your process when there's a new set, for instance, Rebellion Without Rehearsal? What does rules do just as an overall view throughout that whole process, throughout the development and the playtesting and then the final product?
So card development is a really iterative process, and we work very closely with the development team. We also work with the design team in the earlier stages, but we get sort of more and more involved as we get closer and closer to the final set. We've also gotten our relationship between the teams to be tighter over the years, over the sets. So nowadays we have a interdepartmental card review process where we have a meeting. We'll take up like 10 to 20 cards at a time, depending on how long a time slot we could find for everybody from all different parts of the world to come to a meeting. And we will be able to give each other feedback. So rules can say, this problem is going to come up with this card, or this needs to be technically different. Development can say, hey, design, we're concerned about this card that you gave us, when it's like they recently handed it off. And so dev is working from them, or like, we need to change this card. What were the design goals that it needed to fill, and sort of talk about things at that level. So I'd been pushing for a while to get like a more formal structure, but we have for a long time been in the regular habit of like, dev will come to us with a card. The development team will come to us in the roles team with a card, and we'll talk about how to make it work. And that can be just working with different variations. It can be like, okay, you can't do it this way because of this technical problem. What about this phrasing? Does that have any implications that matter? Because the dev team knows like which of the corner cases that we think about are actually relevant to standard, right? So the difference between updating existing cards and making new cards is that if a card isn't printed yet, we have a lot more freedom to change those corner cases. But we want to make sure that we don't change the important cases in ways that the development team is not expecting, and that will, you know, basically invalidate the results of playtesting. So yeah, sometimes it's just like, especially late in the process, it can be more like that, trying to maintain the functionality in all of the important ways. But we also do a lot of like just making suggestions like, okay, you're working in this general space. Here are four ideas for things that you could do in that space that are roughly similar, and maybe will inspire further direction, going in a different direction with the card or whatever change needs to happen. But that like, you know, avoid or otherwise clean up something that got convoluted. Because in the development process, it's natural to be like, okay, this needs to be toned down or restricted in some way. So let's add a caveat or a new clause or something. And the development team has also gotten better over the years at, you know, not overdeveloping cards and recognizing when adding complexity or adding restrictions makes sense and when it's time to step back and do something that's different at a larger scale. But yeah, we try to help them make those transitions.
It sounds like sort of every card gets sort of looked at by all the teams together. Are there any specific cards in our most recent set that sort of stand out as cards that really benefited and really had a lot of discussion between the rules team and the other teams in their development?
Yeah, I've got a whole list of examples here. just to pick a few of them, Sudden Commandment is the NBN operation with the new mandate subtype. And it says, it has numbers on it. We mostly ignore the numbers in the rules team. We let the development folks and the playtesters worry about that. But the text on it says, draw two cards. You may play one non-terminal operation from HQ. Threat three, if this operation is the first mandate you played this turn, you may pay three credits to gain a click. And then it has the reminder text about what threat means. So this card had a lot of nuanced implications depending on which version we were talking about. So I was insistent that we avoid a lot of these problems by just saying it has to be a non-terminal operation. You can't play an operation and then gain a click after your action phase has ended, because that would be awkward. or like, I believe there were some versions in some stage of playtesting where it was like play two operations in a row rather than play an operation and gain a click. And that was even more confusing about whether you could resolve it fully after playing a terminal. So like, okay, the first of the two things that you're doing can't be a terminal. And that avoided, you know, whatever problems. And then the threat ability, I don't remember as well the specific like iterations that went through, but you know, we helped the developers figure out how to get it so that like you couldn't like stack them up. Actually, narrative contributed to that too by creating the mandate subtype was partially introduced for this balance concern, but also the narrative team kind of ran with it and said, yeah, we want to do this way. We want to add a subtype. So we'll see if mandate comes up again. I don't know whether we'll see that subtype again.
Narrative is also part of this sort of cross discussion. And so rules and development sort of keyed in that we need this extra term to make the card work good. And yeah, then
narrative,
that's cool.
Narrative has some involvement. Like they pay attention to what's going on in playtesting. They try to get an idea of what the cards look like. They don't finalize flavor text until after rules text is finalized, or at least mostly finalized. And if they want to like push back on us, we're open to that. If they need more space. But you know, they do a lot of like drafting, writing the flavor text, cause they couldn't do it all after the rules text is finalized, because that would sort of push things back. Cause they need time to do that. So there's overlap and there's, so actually Jinho is a really good example about rules and development and narrative all working together. So Jinho is the new criminal hardware weapon. It's unique and it has a bunch of text. It says, when your turn ends, if you made a successful run on HQ, R&D, and Archives this turn, you may add this hardware to your score area as an assassination agenda worth 0 agenda points. Then, if you have 3 assassination agendas in your score area, you win the game. Threat 3, whenever you bypass a piece of ice, you may spend a click to install this hardware from your heap. So there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of work on the development side went into, okay, how do we make this secondary ability so that you don't lose your Jeton host to random like net damage? And how do we do that in a way that doesn't make it a better card for anarchs than criminals? And that we ended up with the bypass condition, which is something very criminal. But then the main part of adding an agenda, and if you get all 3 copies, you quest 3 different times, then you win the game, had technical issues. So when a card is converted into an agenda, it loses all of its original characteristics. It's just an agenda with the point value that it says. This is something that had to be clarified because of Kasi String, which is an older card, an FFG card that is unique when it's on the board, when it's installed, but adds itself to the score area as an agenda. So it had to be clarified that, yeah, it loses its name and its unique status, or else you wouldn't be able to have like an installed Kasi String and a scored Kasi String at the same time. And so that made it harder to keep track of, well, which agendas at a technical level does the game see as the 3 Jeton hosts? And so there were a couple of different solutions to how to make that work. And the one that we went with was, we'll give it a subtype. So agendas can have, converted agendas can have characteristics if we say that they have those characteristics. And it was looking like there wasn't going to be room for flavor text on the card. So the assassination subtype, I think, really helps clarify what's going on, right? Mercury killed three people. And that was a big part of the rebellion with our rehearsal. And it's also, it's a big deal because of, you know, Mercury's a Bioroid and they're not supposed to be able to do that. But, you know, we can't fit, you know, an entire like fiction piece on a card. but I think the art and the rules text work together well to still convey a significant chunk of that narrative. So I'm proud of how that ended up.
Yeah, in the narrative team, what we do is we develop a whole set of flavor texts. So everyone in the team offers, if they can, their own version of what the flavor text would be on each card. And even people outside the narrative team offer flavor text. So we have a lot of options, but then we don't finalize until rules finalizes the rules text. And then we pick. Are there other cards that you think are really notable in Rebellion Without Rehearsal? I've noticed a lot of people talking about Pretty Mary as a card. Is that one that's kind of notable or interesting to talk about?
Yeah, so Pretty Mary has an unusual effect. So it is the first time that we've had to refer to on a card the number of cards you're going to access directly. So in the comprehensive rules, when we were updating the access and breach rules, we needed a term for this concept, but we couldn't really find one that we were super happy with. We went with random access limit. So if you look in the comprehensive rules, it will talk about the random access limit for HQ and R&D. Now, it's not actually random for R&D. It's going down from the top. And in some senses, it's not random for HQ either, or at least it's without replacement. But like, we just needed a term, and that was good enough for the CR. It wasn't good enough to put on a card. So we had a lot of debate about how are we going to say what this card does. It's pretty intuitive, but we have a formality to the style. So we went with, the final text is, whenever you breach R&D, if you are allowed to access two or more cards in R&D during this breach, you may access one additional card. There's also a rules gotcha that we wanted to avoid. So the timing point that this happens in is the step where, like, when you breach, triggers happen. And pretty much all of those effects, everything that happens at that window, is just get extra accesses or spend some resource to get extra accesses. And we usually make those mandatory just for simplicity. Like, you don't need to click through a prompt to get an additional access that doesn't cost you anything. Like, you have to pay for, you know, wake implant counters or whatever. But if it's just you get an access, you just get the access. But there was a weird thing where in any reaction window, the player gets to decide what order to resolve their triggers in. So if for some reason you didn't want to access a third card with Pretty Mary, you could just resolve that first and get around it. So in order to not like give an advantage to people who understood this like weird way to exploit the timing, we decided normally we don't, but we'll just make this an optional access so that everybody can just see that you can decline this extra access if you are, you know, multi-accessing against Jinteki and they didn't have enough money to fire a snare last turn, but this turn they do and you only want to access two cards.
Oh, yeah. So theoretically, like if you had, say, twin encounters or wake counters, you could say, oh, I'm going to access a card and then I'm going to do Mary's ability on Breach and then I'm going to do the twinning ability and access another card, but I'm not going to access one from Mary because when I activate it or when I use that ability, I wasn't accessing two cards, but now I am. So that used to be something you could do, or is something you could do. Am I understanding that right?
So you use all of your get extra accesses abilities first, right? Those all happen in the when you breach reaction window. And then we calculate the final value and lock that in. Then you actually start accessing cards. So when you're resolving those abilities and adding up the extra accesses, since Pretty Mary wants to know if you've already gotten extra accesses, if you use Pretty Mary first, you haven't gotten any other extra accesses yet. So it doesn't give you another one. But if you have like twin encounters to spend or whatever, and you resolve that first, then Pretty Mary does what she's supposed to do. So you still need to do them in the right order, but generally people will do them in the right order. And that's not too bad. But by making the ability optional, we removed the corner case where you actually want to not get a card for Pretty Mary. And so you resolve them in the wrong order on purpose.
Right. And even though you're all rules heads in the rules team, you don't want to make Netrunner a game of, oh, I know this obscure rules interaction, so I'm better than you. And so that's really cool. So Pretty Mary is worded in a way where not having that esoteric knowledge of the rules doesn't disadvantage you. That's cool.
Exactly. Yeah, we work really hard to try to keep things as simple and clear as possible. And that kind of leads into another example of like just pragmatics. And that is the Maw problem. So Maw is not from Rebellion Rehearsal. It's an FFG card. It's an Anarch console. And it says, as well as giving you memory and stuff, the first time each turn you access a card not in archives and do not steal or trash it, the corp must trash one card from HQ at random. So why is that a problem? Well, when you're playing in-person Netrunner, players are like pulling cards out of each other's hands. Like you take damage, you present your hand face down to the corp and they grab the cards. Obviously not necessarily literally, like you maybe put the cards down on the table and they pick, but it is sort of part of the flow of the game on both sides. You've got damage for the runners and you've got HQ accesses for the corp. That when you grab a card out of your opponent's hand, you're going to flip it over. So Maw is a problem card in like an organized play perspective. But you know, even if you're not playing in a tournament and you accidentally flip over an agenda, that kind of wrecks the game state, right? That sucks. Cause it was an accident probably. And you know, now your decision tree is compromised. Like, okay, well now I know there's an agenda in archives. So I was going to wait another turn. Maybe I was going to run. I haven't decided yet. So there are two cards in Rebellion Without Rehearsal that relate to the Maw problem. And one of them is Bring Them Home. We have kind of one success story and one not so much of a success story. So Bring Them Home is the Jinteki card in the like Oppo research cycle. It's an operation terminal black ops. Play only if the runner stole or trashed a corp card during their last turn. After you resolve this operation, your action phase ends. Reveal and add two cards at random from the grip to the top of the stack. Threat three, you may pay two credits to reveal one card in the grip at random. The runner shuffles it into the stack. So there are a bunch of things going on with this card. The development team was sort of turning their knobs, trying to get the right balance of like what effect exactly does it need to be. We don't want to put things like on the bottom because that introduces sort of an obscure, well, now everybody needs to keep track of what's on the bottom of the deck if you really want to play optimally, which is something that a couple of our staff particularly dislike. It's not fun to have to like take a bunch of notes for often very small marginal benefit. So like what the effect was going to be changed a bunch over the course of development. But the point I was driving for just about all of those iterations was we don't want to reproduce the Maw problem. If the corp is going to be grabbing cards from the runner, we don't want to have to give them a game loss. So any iterations that involved randomly picking cards from the runner's grip, we put a reveal on there. Now, there is another card that does have the Maw problem in the same set, and that's Helium Fora, which is an Anarch program. It's a virus. It says, interrupt. Whenever you would access a card in archives, you may host it face up on this program instead. It is not installed. Use this ability only once each time you breach archives. That part is not relevant here. But the second ability is, when the corp purges virus counters, they trash two cards from HQ at random. Trash this program. So we've seen before viruses that, rather than using counters, trash itself when the corp purges. But this one has a new twist on that of the corp has to do a punishment thing before they purge. And unfortunately, we didn't really have the opportunity to do that same, like revealing from HQ has much more significant consequences than revealing from the grip, right?
I know as a TO, I actually really love that you're thinking about the Maw problem. I am optimistic with Helium Fora that because it's, I think one of the tough things with Maw is it's at, when you're accessing cards, you're also doing that random discard. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we won't have the same.
Yeah, it's not happening every turn as
well. It's not happening every turn.
It's one time, it's a tech card, so people are maybe going to be reading it more carefully and thinking a little more about what they're doing rather than just sort of going with the flow of the game. So we'll see how it turns out. If we had had more opportunities to iterate, maybe we could have come up with something that avoided that problem, but we got what we got. And it's not the end of the world. Be careful when you play Helium Fora the same way that you should be careful if you play Maw.
Or any card in the Red Sand cycle, really. Actually, I wanted to ask about a card that you didn't bring up, but has been very popular right after Rebellion Without Rehearsal release, which is Hollow Man, particularly as it relates to another card that you already mentioned this interview, Reconstruction Contract. I was just curious, was that interaction where Hollow Man can put counters on Reconstruction Contract, was that, I suppose that's nothing novel from a rules team standpoint, but was that something on your radar?
Not directly. So I don't think I ever considered reconstruction contracts specifically when thinking about Hollow Man, but I definitely considered sort of the color pie issue that's kind of a technical issue of who gets to cheat at advancing things. So Jinteki is like the most frequently able to put advancement counters on whatever they want. NBN gets it sometimes. Whalen doesn't usually get it. And HB very rarely even puts advancement counters on stuff. I guess Seamless lets them put counters on whatever. But yeah, so NBN, I made a point to ask the developers and the designers, should this and Stoke the Embers only be putting on cards that can advance, or should they be allowed to do anything? And the answer was that it was not important enough to the goals and like the faction identity and things that were going on to be worth adding another line of text. Right? Hollow Man has a lot of words on it. And then Stoke the Embers, we wanted to match Hollow Man. We want similar effects that are designed to work together to match up. Especially if they're like in the same faction in the same set. So I don't know how much the development team was thinking about or not thinking about reconstruction contract in particular, which is like the main implication of that choice as it turned out. But reconstruction contract is kind of a weird card for several reasons and kind of problematic. We already talked about it with regard to no changing game state. So, but yeah, it's Networked is a complicated game. There are lots of things going on.
Thank you so much, Jamie, for giving us all of those insights into the process behind Rebellion Without Rehearsal. Because we received the cards and like, it's really great being able to see all the thinking behind it and that went into them and all of the things I didn't realize we'd avoided, but we avoided them thanks to you. I just wanted to end by asking you, if people have rules questions, what is the best way for them to approach you? Maybe they're simple ones, or maybe they're actually quite a complex question that someone has about a really detailed area. What's best for them to do?
Yeah. So if you are in the Boston area or Cephalopod Wizard or Ruben Peters's locals, ask us in person. If you're in like a Discord server with us or whatever, you can ask us. We're always happy to talk about stuff. But if you want a more formal point of contact, we have a Mastodon account, nullsignalrules@peoplemaking.games, and we have an email. So you can email us at rules@nullsignal.games. And we it takes some time to reply to those more formal communications because we pretty much discuss and work out how we're going to respond to every email that we get and try to give you pretty complete information because the questions that we get by email tend to be fairly involved. But we are planning to respond.
Cool. And just as we're wrapping up, is there anything you'd like to shout out personally or anything you'd like people to contact you personally about or look at?
Yeah, I would love to shout out the other game that I work on, which is Worldbreakers. So Worldbreakers is a card game that you may have heard about, or you may not have heard about. We kickstarted the base set 2 years ago. We sold out the whole first printing. Last summer, we kickstarted the first expansion and also the second printing of the base set. And those are arriving. So people are getting their Worldbreaker sets. And if you want to get into Worldbreakers and you didn't, you know, back the Kickstarter, that's totally fine. You can still get a copy. And if you want to learn about the game, just go to worldbreakersgame.com. So world as in the planet that we live on, breakers as in like things that break ice, and game as in a card game. worldbreakersgame.com.
I was delighted and pleasantly surprised to find out that you were involved in this game. I have heard about it, I think, through Netrunner Spheres. The lead designer, Eliamir, also is a Netrunner player, and so I have a lot of friends who have spoken nothing but praise about this game. It's very well regarded, and it was really nice to hear that you were involved in it too.
Yeah, there's a lot of Netrunner DNA in Worldbreakers. Like, if you look at the basic action card for Worldbreakers, it's very familiar to Netrunner players. Ellie was a big Netrunner player and playtester back in the day, and that's actually how I got involved. Is they knew me from my playtesting days, and they knew that I'm the rules person, so they asked me to consult on streamlining the mechanics and writing the rule book and stuff, and I fell in love with the game and wound up contributing to more and more things. Like, there are a couple of cards in the base set that I like contributed to the mechanics on, and I wrote flavor text for a few of the cards, and was just getting more and more involved. So by the time we did the expansion, I was like fully in as a designer as well as rules manager. So I'm really proud of the work that we did.
I'd also like to shout out, it's a kind of an alternative history of the world.
Yes.
But also the amount of detail and research into, even though it's alternative, it's still kind of very much rooted in what happened in, it's the 13th century, am I right?
The game is set in 13th century Asia. The protagonist of the base set is Kutulun, who is a real historical Mongol princess. And there are a bunch of other real historical figures that show up in the game. Marco Polo is playable out of the core set. Kublai Khan is playable out of the expansion. And there are more. I can't take any credit for the historical stuff. Ellie has done some amazing research and created a just really cool lens into a part of history and the world that I think doesn't get a lot of attention in games. And it's really cool to see that. And it's been cool learning about it as part of working on the game.
Definitely. Yeah. It certainly inspired me to look more into that historical period. Thank you, Jamie. I think you're going to stick with us, and we are now going to move on to the news segment. I'd like to shout out a number of the tournaments that have been going on recently and talk about some of the results. Of course, with Rebellion Without Rehearsal coming out as the new set, there's been like an explosion of tournaments, and I really recommend looking at alwaysberunning.net to see all of the tournaments going on. I wanted to mention in the accelerated meta test tournaments that have been going on. I wanted to say the King has been doing really well and has won two recently in March. And just overnight, my time, Jai won the April standard accelerated meta test. I also wanted to note there's a series of three tournaments called Fly to EMEA. So they're being organized by the tournament organizer for EMEA Continentals. And part of the tournament is, of course, experimenting with the meta and getting to play. They're being held online so that everyone can participate, whether you are going to manage getting to the Europe, Middle East, and Africa Continentals in person, or whether you just want to support, you can participate in this series of three Fly to EMEA tournaments. And part of the tournament idea is that they're also fundraising to help people who have more difficulty with affording the travel. And I'd just like to draw your attention to some of the upcoming tournaments. There's going to be circuit openers in Norwich in the UK, in San Diego, California, in London, and Malta, and also North Melbourne, and in Amsterdam, and Canberra, Australia. And those are coming up probably in the time period just from late March through into halfway through April. You might want to have a look at those tournaments if you are anywhere near them. There are also a number of asynchronous tournaments coming up. There's a return of Nova versus Ampere, which we talked about, Sanjay, a few episodes ago with Vale. And there's also a German Discord league and a Spanish online asynchronous tournament. And I think also a Brazil asynchronous tournament from Brazil. So if you can participate in those, they would also be very cool. Some of those are, they're mostly online. Yes, they are all online. Sorry.
I think an in-person asynchronous tournament would be pretty weird. So that does make sense.
It's true. Although actually, I know that sometimes people do play their asynchronous round in person if they happen to live near each other.
Which is yeah, that's fair.
I've done it. I've lost several of them.
What other things are going on, Sanjay?
Yeah, so looking at the Null Signal Games website, we are recruiting two posts. We are recruiting the EDI team lead. That's the Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion team lead to promote equality, diversity, and inclusion, both within our organization and in the products we make, as well as the...
And the tournaments that we run?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. The tournaments we run. And I know working within Null Signal Games, seeing the effect and the power of having an EDI team has been really appreciated by me. And come, if you think your services would be helpful, please consider applying for the role. Also, we are recruiting for the media team lead. That is a team that's going to be working with our streams, videos, podcasts. I guess you'll be kind of our boss. come apply. I'd love to work with you. So that's one thing that's going on.
And of course, as always, all positions are volunteer, unpaid.
Yes.
That is a good qualification.
Always good to remind people in case they don't know.
Yeah.
In other news, speaking of unpaid work. There's a lot of people not within Null Signal Games that do amazing Netrunner things. And a new post on the Null Signal website has announced the Creator Resources Portal. So if you make Netrunner content, and in making that Netrunner content, it would be helpful for you to have access to some of the art assets, different things that we have access to working within the organization, but would be helpful to you. You can apply to be for access to the Creator Resources Portal, and then you'll have access to that too to help make your streams and videos and whatever else is in your beautiful hearts a reality and look really good. So check that out.
I also wanted to point out the pronunciation guide for Rebellion Without Rehearsal now exists. It's mainly Brazilian Portuguese words, almost totally. And there is a URL there where you can put in the International Phonetic Alphabet or IPA and hopefully listen to the pronunciation if that makes it easier for you.
I really need to spend some more time with the pronunciation guide. I've definitely been pronouncing some card names wrong.
There's a community thing I'd like to shout out, and it's particularly important to me because I'm Australian, and I kind of realize the reason for this. Worlds has so far been held in places that it's actually really expensive. Just the pure flying from Australia to Worlds is very expensive. It's a long distance, so I'm not saying that the airlines are being unfair or anything. It's just very far away and expensive. And that changes the types of people who get to go to Worlds. We have national champions and they very frequently don't get to go to Worlds because it's expensive or whatever. And a group of Australians led by Scarius or Reese, if you know him, have put together an initiative called the Pennies Havers Initiative, which is pun on penny shavers, and brought together, I think it's lots of different artists in Australia who are Netrunner players or friends of Netrunner players, and put together a 72-card alt art pack. And what the aim of that is that the money that is raised from the alt art pack will be used to fund the national champions going to Worlds, or if they don't want to for any reason, then it will kind of pass down to the people who got second or third or whichever place in the upcoming nationals when they happen. And I was just going to say, to me, the pack is extremely Australian, and I don't know whether it comes across as that to you, and I'm very curious as to some of the arts. Like, I love that there's one that is absolutely the way supermarket prices are always displayed, and there is one referring to beer, there is one referring to biscuits, and you're both American, I mean something like cookies. And like there's a sadly
there's a really megafauna cute joke illustrated by someone you might have heard of. That would be Ginevra.
Yes. I like to contribute. If I can to charity things, I like to contribute. But it's very I'm very curious. What are your impressions of it?
Well, I will say the cool S on Estebrado is at least cross-cultural enough that I, as an American, can appreciate cool S's. I didn't pick up on the grocery store reference. Is that the big deal?
Big deal.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love that.
So much like how supermarkets advertise their specials and deals and discounts. Oh,
that's why there's the little $4.25 per ad in the corner.
Yeah. Because
per pound or whatever.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Price per kilogram. How do units work outside of this weird country that I live in?
Better.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool that the Behold AltArt has a link to a TED Talk. People should check that out.
Yeah, I'm sure that's where that link goes.
Is the Volvo Ojetti the biscuits or
it's very much like an Arnott's biscuits pack, and they at least used to. I don't know whether they currently do. They make a biscuit that's called Iced Vovos, which is pink with a red streak of jam on the bottom and looks pretty much like the trash cost.
So not something you would dunk in mint tea, but still thematic for other reasons.
Yeah, I think those two, Vovo and Big Deal, were the ones that, like, from my perspective, it's just, oh, this has unusual graphic design. And I did not pick up on, like, it makes total sense that those are cultural references that Australians would get.
Do I not get the price because I'm, one, not Australian enough, two, not plugged into video games enough, or three, just not cool? It's a stunning art. I love it, but I don't understand it.
I love it. I don't claim to understand it properly,
nice.
But it is really cool. Just for our listeners, I'll describe. It's a skull head wearing maybe VR and looking at a floppy disk.
Full disclosure.
VR headset and floppy disk is an amazing juxtaposition.
Full disclosure, anytime I see something I don't understand, I assume it's from Undertale.
I do not believe this has anything to do with Undertale, except maybe the speech bubble with 2.5 hearts. Although that doesn't seem right either.
It's really good. I like it a lot.
You have one heart in Undertale, I believe.
And I will say, just with regards to these arts, I think there's a few of them that might especially, you know, hit your heart if, you know, you have the Australian cultural references. But looking at these arts, they land. Like, these are really good. I like this a lot. With regard to picking this up, how does one do that?
So it's been uploaded to both Make Playing Cards and also Drive Through Cards, because I know they're easier for different people in different parts of the world. We're going to put a link to those in the description of the podcast. And also Luke from netrunnercards.com.au is selling them and is willing to ship internationally if that's what you need. I also want to shout out your digital. I want to shout out all of these ones. I love your digital life and like how much time you have spent online recently. And I think a lot of people have really liked Riel Kit Peddler. Like, that's a really strong image of her.
It's a good kit.
Yeah.
Well, Ginevra, thank you for showing us that. Please peruse these arts, dear audience, on your own. Jamie, thank you for joining us. Ginevra, it's nice doing an episode with you. Dear audience, thank you for being here, listening to us. Hope you have a wonderful day. Hope you're enjoying Rebellion Without Rehearsal. Hope you're enjoying your lives. And I hope to see you around in these Netrunner spaces. Goodbye.